Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The current issue of South Dakota Magazine highlights South Dakota's oldest town. Another feature explores warrior culture in the state as it intersects with Native American culture. Joining me now in our studios in Vermilion, Bernie Hunhoff and Katie Hunhoff. Katie is publisher of South Dakota Magazine. Bernie is editor at large. Katie Hunhoff, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Bernie Hunhoff, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, Lori. It's always fun.
Yeah, this is the part where I just editorialize and tell the whole state how much I love this magazine. I was just telling you before we came on the air, it's indispensable.
Well, that's...
I think to the state of South Dakota, and there's my commercial. They did not pay me to say that, nor did they give me a free subscription. So that's just...
No, we appreciate that a lot. Indispensable, that's about as kind as thing as you can say about a magazine. Thank you, Lori.
It's good stuff. We have family in Maine, and they have a fabulous magazine called Down East.
Down East, yeah, great.
Uh-huh, and another indispensable. To the folks of New England there, and we've really done that here in South Dakota. It's a rare thing. If you go out to Maine and you bring this magazine, they look through and they say, can I have that?
Oh, no, that's
you probably
like
have subscribers in Maine.
No, I'm sure we do. Yeah, in fact, we have a subscriber right at the very southeastern tip of Maine who's he's hunted in South Dakota and fished, but he's never lived in South Dakota, but he's just crazy about South Dakota. And he's been getting the magazine for years. He's a vintage gun dealer. And we went out and visited him one time. And you're right. Maine and South Dakota have a lot in common, actually.
Yeah. How far is the subscription base? Where do you have subscribers?
We have subscribers across the whole country in all the states. And we have subscribers, I think, almost on every continent, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
We have a lot of international subscribers as well. Those are kind of our favorite subscriber. Oh, well, not favorite. Our favorite.
You're our favorite,
right here. But no, I really do love hearing stories though about people who just really love South Dakota, subscribe to the magazine, who don't have any ties here and haven't lived here, but just realize that it's a really special place.
And then if you live here and move away, I bet a lot of those folks are. Do you have a sense of who your core subscribers are, what they're looking for in a magazine? What's your relationship with subscribers?
Yeah, because we do everything in-house at the magazine. We do a lot of magazines farm out their subscriptions and farm out different aspects of the business. We do everything right in-house in an old territorial governor's house in Yankton. So we have constant all-day-long communication with our readers, and we're really close to them. I think it's part of our reason for our success. And they have story ideas and comments and ideas and tips for us all the time.
Yeah.
So we're constantly communicating with them. And what we've learned is there are a lot of really, really good South Dakotans who don't get to live in South Dakota. They're living all over the country in the world, and yet they're passionate about South Dakota, and they're just a lot of fun to work with those folks.
The writing in the magazine matters. That's what I'm not done geeking out yet.
No, you're doing good, actually.
Keep on going.
Sorry. But the writing matters still after all these years. How come when so many other magazines are going to shorter formats and more social media versus the content that's being generated. How do you keep that balance?
Well, first of all, you just got to entertain people, and that was true when we started 33 years ago. I mean, we always thought if we could just entertain people, they would maybe they'd write us a check once a year, and we could stay in business. And nothing has changed that way. And you can't give it away free online. Seems like a pretty basic thing to an old school business person like me. And the internet's actually been our friend. We find younger readers, new readers all over the country, the world, and the state through the internet, and we kind of get them hooked on good writing and good photography, and we let them know that the best of it's always going to be in the paper magazine, and eventually they respond. So it's been working for us very well.
So as a business model, the best is still in the magazine, and that's intentional.
Yeah, if we do a story like the Fort Pierce story we're going to talk about, if we do a story in the magazine, we put our best effort into the print publication. And then later down the road, Katie and the staff will maybe edit it and put it up online maybe in 6 months or a year or 2 years. So we eventually get the content up online, but the best and the freshest is going to be in the paper magazine.
Interesting. Katie, 15 years you've been with the magazine. How has it changed in just that 15 years? How fast is the business changing?
Oh, it was a really great time for me to get involved in the magazine 15 years ago. When I joined the staff in June, and I think that same June we bought our first digital camera. So I think I came right when things were changing. Back then, before then, the way you lay out a magazine, everything was completely different. But kind of in the last 15 years from when I've started, some things that have been really fun for us are printing has the capability of the printer to print really beautiful photos is great. And at the same time, we have more wonderful photographers in the state than we've ever had before, right. Taking, you know, great photos. And that is all because of digital cameras. It's so much easier now. Everybody's taking photos. And so that really took off. I feel like there's way more photographers than ever before. And our printer can, you know, print the colors really beautifully now. And that wasn't always the case. I mean, mm-hmm. for a long time, you know, we kind of struggled with things like that. Or we only had black and white pages to print. And we had to say, okay, only these like five pages are going to be color. Yeah. So technologically, it's been a really fun time to work at the magazine.
All right. We're going to talk about a couple of the main features from this particular issue. There's lots more in the issue that we're not going to cover today, but Fort Pierre. Let's take us to Fort Pierre. Katie wrote the story. Mm-hmm. Bernie took the photos for this one. So you take a little road trip, and you spend time in Fort Pierre, and what do you find out that's surprising to you that you didn't know about this community?
You know, I would say, first of all, I do want to say it was surprising. So I'm not going to be making up an answer here. Now, the whole day was kind of surprising for us. I feel, you know, what's special about Pierre is that they have a really rich history. You know, so much history that, like, a story like this is a little bit hard to write because you're tying up so many, you know, trying to put everything into context as far as, you know, how the, what's happening presently in the town
right,
and how
yeah.
it connects to that history. But we went up there on a really beautiful day. We met with the mayor of Pierre, Glory Hansen, and she's a dynamo. She's very energetic, very excited about all the new things happening in town, too. So she was a great person to put that into context for us.
How long does it take to own? There's a timeline here of 200 years of Fort Pierre. There's photos. There's multiple interviews and stories that are interwoven. How long does it take to put something like that together?
Well, we had to plan in advance because I think we went out to Fort Pierre probably a year ago from now.
Okay.
So it took some planning as far as that goes. But most of our interviews, we like to do in person. We did right there when we were in Pierre. We went up and down Main Street. We went out to a buffalo ranch and walked around. So I think most of the interviews we did on the field, and my dad takes the photos. I just was handwriting notes.
Yeah.
And so it came together pretty easily. The timeline, you know, I had to go to the library for that.
Right.
But
some good old-fashioned number crunching. Yep. There. The original history, for folks who don't know, just give them a little taste of the article and really how this town was founded and how quickly it really changed
yep.
from one thing to another.
So the story is called 200 Years of Town, and I think that's surprising right off the bat for a lot of people because nobody really realizes that we would have a town that's 200 years old.
Right.
And it was started as a trading post. So it's kind of called the oldest continuous settlement in South Dakota. So that was in 1817, and the trading post was called Fort La Framboise. And that is, I think, the French pronunciation. So
sure.
I feel like a lot of people know that as, I don't even know, Fort La Framboise. And just like, you know, there's a couple different ways to pronounce Pierre. And so that's one of them. And there's throughout the whole story, there's a lot of Pierre pronunciation. So I was kind of nervous to go on the radio. It's one thing to try to get them spelled right. Another thing to try to pronounce them. But yep, so it was started as a trading post in 1817. So it wasn't called Fort Pierre right off the bat. I think Fort Pierre was the third fort to be built in the area.
Right. And the mayor does a really nice job in the beginning putting the history into context, and I'll just read her quotation here. It says, mm-hmm. 33 years before the Declaration of Independence was signed, two French guys claimed it. She says, when the fort was established, Napoleon was occupying Europe. The War of 1812 was raging. Lewis and Clark were making their trek, and the Louisiana Purchase was being negotiated. And then you have Fort Pierre being settled. The history just blows me away. And when you put it all into context like that, it really does sort of make you think about what people knew, what news traveled to them and what didn't, and how they were making a living here.
You know, the Missouri River was the interstate highway of the time, really. There was no railroad to reach Fort Pierre in you know, through its first 100 years almost. So the interstate highway as we know it today was that river. And just as an interstate highway, lots of really interesting people came up and down that river. And if I could, Katie's story has a quote from Edward Arnsberger, who was a missionary who came there in 1880.
Right.
And did you read that quote? Can I read just a bit
Please,
of that? We have
yeah.
time. So this missionary comes in 1880 and he writes, he found this quote, strange mixture of Americans, English, Irish, Swedes, Norwegians, Russians, Poles, French, Canadians, Indians, and whatnot, Protestants, Catholics, spiritualists, moralists, liberals, free lovers, and he goes on and on. He says, nearly all the people were in hot and eager pursuit of the almighty dollar. Freighters and cowboys and adventurers from all over the world were duly represented. And he said, the night before I got there, two young men, stimulated by whiskey, drew their pistols on each other in a miserable dance hall, and one of them fell dead at the feet of his assailant. And in a few hours, he was buried on a hillside just back of town with no more ceremony than if he'd been a dog. And then the Reverend, wanting to end on an optimistic note, wrote, he found a way to conclude his report. He said, it was indeed first-class missionary ground without any mistake. So, I mean, that's the kind of town it was then. And it's still just a really interesting town with a really interesting mix of people.
Yeah. How do you see the legacy of that kind of history in Fort Pierre today? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's got those three, Katie and I found it's got those, you want to talk
about
that?
Sure, yeah, and so this is another, something that we just kind of realized when we went to go visit, when we're talking to the mayor and kind of exploring Fort Pierre again. You know, we've been publishing the magazine since 1985, okay. So we've been to Fort Pierre a couple times, but things are definitely changing there. And one thing we noticed that there's really three different Fort Pierres. There's Old Fort Pierre, the downtown, that has some kind of legendary, bars and places where legislators and cowboys have been hanging out for decades, and there's a saddle shop where a guy is making saddles for some of the world champion saddle bronc riders in the whole country. So there's the kind of old Fort Pierre that has a lot of the history and the the legendary meeting that happened at the where the original fort was built. And but then there's also another Fort Pierre that has sprung up recently that's kind of like a beautiful housing development, like one that you would find in like Omaha or Sioux Falls. But unlike those places, it has this beautiful Missouri River where you can just dock your boat right out your back door. And so that's kind of like another Fort Pierre. It's Fort Pierre, but it's located a little bit north of there. And then right at the base of the bridge going across the pier, there's a whole, we think, another kind of Fort Pierre forming that they're planning. They have big plans for a new marina, I think new housing development, and kind of like a whole nother development happening there. Sure. So there's lots of new things happening in Fort Pierre. We spent most of our time in Old Fort Pierre, of course. But
what's the role of this town in lawmaking in South Dakota?
A very interesting one. I first went in the legislature in 1993, and the Silver Spur and the it was going strong, and that's place where cowboys and Native Americans and politicians and farmers and business people, all sorts, a whole mix of people would go there in the evenings and hash out everything, and they claim a lot of, I never struck any bargains there, but they claim a lot of legislative bargains were struck there. And old Ed Duffy, who died just a couple years ago, Ed Duffy had the Chateau, a legendary old steakhouse, again, just a great mix of people. And, the old story was, the river is also the border for the time zone, for the central mountain time zone. So, of course, the old joke was people would hang out in Pier until the bars closed, and then they'd go over to Fort Pier and finish up their negotiating.
Shut them down again.
Negotiating and their socializing. And it was a wild place. It's tamed down. For a year, then the Chateau and the Silver Spur sadly closed for a period of time. But now it may be symbolic of the town as a whole. The Silver Spur has reopened much more as a family-style restaurant, maybe a little more fitting the times. And I imagine politicians still hang out there some, but it's much, much calmer. And now the good news is a young businessman is going to reopen the Chateau, so it's kind of cool to see those old traditional places are reopening.
If you're just tuning in, my guests, Bernie Hunhoff, Katie Hunhoff. You can hear the magazine pages flipping as we flip through our copies of South Dakota Magazine, the current issue. And another story we want to cover here is this story and photos by Bernie Hunhoff. It's called Warriors First, and it's a look at why descendants of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse are ardent defenders of today's USA. Bernie, where did this story come from? What's the genesis of it?
I think a lot of us have always been intrigued by how patriotic many of our reservation communities and our Native American families are. You know, anybody who's traveled the nine reservations can see that very clearly. Go to some of the small towns, and the American Legion Hall or the VFW will be like the leading social center in the town. That's also somewhat true of other rural towns, but especially on reservations. And go to the cemetery, sadly, and you'll see lots of graves of veterans. You'll see graves marked with American flags. And there's a bit of a paradox there because, let's face it, Native Americans and the U.S. government have not always gotten along so good. And in fact, basically the U.S. government came in and, changed their whole way of life and beat them militarily, pushed them onto reservations, killed all the buffalo, made treaties, broke treaties, and now there's been one controversy after another ever since, when health care and taxation and economic development or whatever it is, there seems like there's a lot of friction between Native Americans and the U.S. government. But going back really to the Revolutionary War, whenever the U.S. government has been in trouble, it seems like our Native American young men, and now young women too, are among the first to sign up. They're very, very patriotic. So there's always been that paradox, and I thought it would be fun. We've never explored that really in South Dakota Magazine. We thought this story could do that.
And it's fascinating to go back to the Revolutionary War in every single war sense. Were you able to get an overall sense of why? Is it something that's deeply embedded in the culture? Is it something that, America has pressed them for more service than other people? Where does it come from?
Certainly the military has reached out to them. I wasn't around the Revolutionary War, but I think I think if you do read back in history, you can see where the military leaders have reached out to them, recognizing that they, back in the Revolutionary War days, they had certain skills. Especially they knew the countryside, so they made great trackers and scouts. They knew the territory very well, so there's that tradition. And I think it's defending homeland. I mean, there's a warrior culture there that really relates to the defense of our country, and it was there 200 years ago. It's just as strong today.
So no matter whatever internal conflict or ongoing issue you might have, there's a time and a place for people to just sign up and serve, continue.
Clearly they can compartmentalize. My wife says I'm really good at compartmentalizing. I can hardly pronounce it, but I can do it. No, they can set aside other grudges when the priority is to defend their homeland and to defend their country. And that's impressive.
Is there a difference between how a Native American community or a reservation or a tribal community or even a Native American family living in an urban center, is there a difference between how they have these conversations about military service, how they welcome people home? What do you know?
Exactly. Especially the smaller Native American communities, I mean, military service is really exalted, and you can see it again. You can see that the VFW Club, the American Legion Club, will be a big deal. We want a lot of this story is based around a little community of Rock Creek. Some people know that as Bullhead. But interestingly, they changed the name about 10 years ago. They haven't changed the name on the highway, and they haven't changed the name in the highway maps. But the Standing Rock Reservation changed the name from Bullhead to Rock Creek because it came to their attention. Well, they knew it all along, I'm sure. Bullhead was the name of the man who killed Sitting Bull. And they thought at some point, we should not be naming a town after the guy who killed Sitting Bull. So here's this little tiny town that they're even still changing their name just to kind of get back at the U.S. government. But that town, if you go to that town, it's about 300 people on the Standing Rock Reservation, about a half hour west of Mobridge. And right in the middle of town, there's a tiny little park, modest little park, and there's an American Doughboy statue, the Doughboy who's, from World War I, the army's infantrymen from World War I. And around it is a Lakota circle in the traditional colors, the statue's been there since the 1930s, lovingly tended to, painted so many times that it's almost mummified from the paint, and they continue to take care of it today, and they have for three or four generations. And the town is run by the American Legion Post, you might almost say, and the American Legion officers, and they The social calendar revolves around Memorial Day, VJ Day, when the celebration of defeating of the Japanese surrender in August, and then Veterans Day. And those are the three big events on the social calendar. And the American Legion Club just pretty much, you might say, runs the town. Right. I don't think it's an organized community with the municipality, but the American Legion Club kind of, just runs the social calendar. They take care of the city park. They do everything. And if you go out in the local cemeteries, there's a 15-foot pole. Across the cemetery, you'll see all these metal flag poles. They're like 15 feet high. And some local Native American blacksmith makes those, and they put them on the grave of every veteran, and they fly flags on those three Memorial Days, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and VJ Day. And, I mean, the whole community is just so wrapped up in patriotism. And it would be beautiful to see in any community. And you'll see the same thing in other rural communities. But they, nobody's going to top Rock Creek for patriotism.
So I wonder then, you've done a great job of showing us what that looks like in the community and the impact of years, decades of a tradition of military service. What do you suppose, and this is maybe a philosophical question to extrapolate, but what's been the impact for American military might based on the fact of indigenous people in this country standing in line and signing their names? Can we do it without them?
Well, I suppose, they're a minority population in the country, even a minority in South Dakota, where I think they represent 9 or 10% of the population. But across the country, they'd be a much smaller population. So we could probably do it without them, but they've certainly made huge sacrifices, again, dating back for a couple hundred years. And the women as well, dating back for a long time. We mentioned in the story that one of the earliest records we can find of the Lakota people signing up for military service came in 1898 during the war.
Spanish-American War.
Thank you, Spanish-American War. And four women from the Standing Rock Reservation joined a Catholic convent and ended up in Havana, Cuba, serving over there. I think their mother superior died and was buried over there, if I remember the story correctly. And, so they went, traveled. And can you imagine, four young Lakota women from in that day and age had probably never been to Morebridge.
Right.
Well, Morebridge didn't exist yet, so they definitely were not in Morebridge. Probably never been to Fort Pierre. So, and, probably never been 50 miles from home and ended up in Havana, Cuba, tending to American soldiers. And then, the oral traditions are really interesting. And, of course, you always, in the magazine business and in the radio business, you want to be careful with oral history. You want to check it out. But the oral history of service in World War I is really interesting. And the word is that at the time when Native Americans were not even citizens, they were not even granted citizenship, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the U.S. government was telling them, they outlawed the Sundance and religious rituals, and I think they even outlawed speaking the language to a certain degree. And yet in World War I, the Defense Department sent word out to the chiefs asking if the young men would sign up. And one of the reasons they wanted them to sign up was they realized they had a different language and they wanted them to be code talkers. So the very language that one branch of government was saying should be outlawed, another branch of government, the Defense Department, was saying we need that skill to defeat the Germans in World War I.
Somebody had an awareness. Wait a minute, that language might be...
And the story that we heard in oral history was that from veterans officials in the Standing Rock was that the word went out to the chief of the Standing Rock Reservation and asked whether or not the young men could serve. And he deliberated on it and decided, yes, we should defend our country and defend our homes, and sent word out across the reservation to tell the young man, yes, you're free to sign up if you wish. Mm-hmm. And they did in big numbers.
All right. Katie, any final thoughts? As you were looking through this article, or did you just get to sort of read it and learn, did you learn a lot new from the pages of your own magazine?
I thought it was a fascinating article. And, this is the kind of article that we love to have in the magazine. Yeah. The magazine, we've been printing it since 1985. We've never broached this topic or discussed it. So not only for me, but for everyone on the staff, I think it was like a whole new topic. So can you remember what made you go up to Rock Creek?
Well, one thing, it's interesting, so many people on the Cheyenne, on the nine reservations really, but especially the Standing Rock, can trace their history to Sitting Bull. And a number of Native American families can also trace their history to Crazy Horse, both killed by the American government. And yet their descendants are so patriotic. And we came across a story of a soldier, Moses Clown, who died in 1918 in World War I. and was brought home to burial. And I read an article about, if you can call a burial a grand thing, but the grand and multi-day ceremony that was put on for Moses Clown, I think he would have been a grandson or a great-grandson of Crazy Horse, as he came back as a hero fighting for the country that mm-hmm. basically killed his great-grandfather. And so we thought we'd go investigate that and see if any clown family members were around. There's a little town called Thunder Butte that's mostly populated by the clown family, and they still tend to his grave out in the middle of the prairie by the Moreau Creek. And it's a, you know, and they're very patriotic, and yet they've also still got some gripes about the U.S. government.
Bernie Hunhoff is editor-at-large at South Dakota Magazine. Katie Hunhoff is publisher, and you can find the latest issue of the magazine on newsstands now or subscribe. That way it comes directly to your mailbox. See, I got one more in there. one more geeking out
Just
on the magazine.
Just keep on talking, Laurie.
Hunhoff, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Our
Thanks
pleasure.
For having us.